ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
If this thing is built, it will be a miracle to behold.
One of science's biggest promises.
It would be like the Wright brothers moment.
Governments, spies, billion-dollar investments, and scientific rivalries.
The control that's required is rivaled only by what God did in creating the universe.
Will quantum computers change everything? I'm Jacinta Bowler. Search for Science Friction, Dead and Alive, on ABC Listen, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to ABC Radio National's The Bookshelf. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough. And each week we sift through piles of books to bring you news of the ones we find interesting.
And we're going to continue to explore favourite Australian books in the lead up to our Top 100 Australian Books Countdown. And novelist, playwright and actor George Kemp watched someone jump into Sydney Harbour, and that led him to his favourite Australian novel.
Okay, all will be revealed later on. Today's books, though, take us into underground mysteries and small-town lives in American writer Daniel Mason's Country People, and two stories of art and friendship in Dave Eggers' Contrapposto.
And we turn away from realism in Australian poet Maria Takalander's The End of Romance, a woman and her son surviving in a dystopian landscape where at the age of 16, young men are supposed to sail off to a new promised land.
Okay, well, to get us into these books, let's say good day to today's reviewers, performer and writer Tim Rogers from UMI and novelist Madeline Gray, whose book Chosen Family has just this week been released in the United States. Hello and hello.
Hello, lovely to be here. Thank you for having me.
Engorged with happiness to be here. Congratulations, Madeline, that's wonderful.
Oh, and thank you.
Are you pleased with the cover?
I am. I think the cover's really beautiful, actually.
It is.
It's a dog kind of being welcomed into a family of lions, which gets to the chosen family idea of the book very well. I mean, unfortunately, they didn't do my suggestion of a koala and kangaroos, but next time.
And you yourself, Tim, you've been off adventuring recently, been on tour.
I was overbeing my wife's handbag at the Houston Ballet Company and found some great bookstores in Houston and read some great writers, but the bookstore was the great one. It was a secondhand bookstore in the suburbs of Houston, and I walked there every day. And on the fourth day, the owner approached me and said, "Are you the gentleman who was in the other day?" And I thought, oh, my God, I've left a puddle of sweat or something. It was high summer. But she said, "We love it when English people come over here." And I said, "I have to ask, what was it about me that made you think I was English?" And she said, "The way you dress." I didn't know quite how to take it. But then we went through Texas authors that they both loved, she and her partner, and then they showed me the baseball section out the back, which was two other rooms of baseball books. So I came back with two suitcases full of great books from Houston, and that's about the end of the story.
Well, let's stick with American fiction. We've got a bit of a theme emerging here on the bookshelf because you've both read American novels for us, and we'll begin with the latest from Dave Eggers.
Now, Dave Eggers, you'll remember, shot to fame in the year 2000 with his book A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius, which I think everybody admired and hated at the same time, whoever wanted to write a book because it was such a good title.
Mm-hmm.
Irresistible to pick up. But it did tell a very sad story, and that was one that was parallel to Dave Eggers' own life. Mm. His father died when he and his siblings were young. He and his sister, Beth, were in their sort of late teens, and they had a younger brother as well, and then the mother died very quickly soon after, and so the book was based on that experience.
And that was a book that was a sort of combination memoir and used fictional elements as well. That was published in 2000, and since then he's written 14 novels,
mm-hmm.
including You Shall Know Our Velocity, What is the What, and The Hologram for the King, as well as six books of nonfiction, 16 kids' books, and of course he founded McSweeney's, both the publishing house and the literary journal.
Mm-hmm. Which is actually his mother's maiden name.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, he's got an incredible energy and output.
Yeah.
And a lot of it seems to be, Madeline, well, what's the word for it? Because it's not a natural instinct for me, but it's, you know.
What does it seem to be? American?
Like, for the better good of other humans.
Oh, right. He's altruistic.
Altruistic. Okay. Thank you. Yeah, he seems to have, you know, the greater good as part of his main focus.
Absolutely. And he's just started a new kind of art program called Art Plus Water in SF, I'm pretty sure, where he spends time, which is a way for visual artists to get access to art school without having to pay $100,000 to go to university. So, yeah, he's very interested in art, which then feeds into the book that we're going to be talking about too.
Mm-hmm.
And a whole lot of charities and charitable organisations and other things that are all about creativity as well as visual arts and as well as writing. And so that brings us, I guess, to that latest novel of his, Contrapposto.
Yes, and this is being heralded, I think, as a return to form for Dave Eggers. Like, it's been warmly received in the US in some, you know, significant places. So that's interesting. But the title, Madeline, Contrapposto, it doesn't have bestseller written all over it to me, but it's a very interesting concept. It's the style of standing that appears in art, in sculpture and painting, where it was a step into a more natural stance where there's the weight on one foot and perhaps a raised hip or shoulder, a more kind of gestural stance rather than a formal one, which appeared pretty much, I think, in, I don't know, 500 BC in Greece in the Western tradition.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of about art and authenticity. So the contrapposto pose is apparently embodying that. It's taking a slice of life in the way that life is and not as we want to present ourselves.
Yes. And this is just beginning to touch on the central theme of the book. Perhaps we should just describe the way it opens, because it is very sweet. There's this young boy whose name's actually Robert, because he's got this awful stepfather who's also called Robert. He chooses to allow others to call him Cricket, which is his nickname. And he lives with his mother, and there's a grandfather called Silas around. But he's got this talent that becomes clear.
Yeah, I mean, they're beautiful opening passages. I really was taken in immediately. It's the 1970s, it's the Midwest, and you've got this little boy, Cricket, who spends a lot of time by himself. He doesn't have, you know, really friends at school, and in his own home he stays downstairs because if he goes upstairs then his stepdad's going to probably beat him up or do something else egregious. And we have this gorgeous moment quite early on in the novel where he's walking across a bridge and comes to meet a girl, Pia, and another boy who becomes irrelevant. Pia says to him, "Hey, I've seen that you do like cool art and calligraphy in class. Would you mind doing some calligraphy of some words I'm going to tell you as graffiti on like a playground or something, is it?" And he goes, "Yeah, all right," like thrilled to be asked to do something by a kid who's slightly older and a girl at that. And he begins to do the most kind of beautiful and ornate graffiti works of what soon we realise are just kind of euphemisms about masturbation. I can't remember.
Yeah, like, you know, the like, dog.
Yeah, exactly. Sock the jock or whatever. and he sees in this moment, he feels he's met a kindred spirit, because this girl clearly has a mind that he doesn't think, you know, belongs in the milieu that he's been in his area. And she describes his work as ornate. And I think this was the first time I got a sense of what the novel would be, because, you know, she says the word ornate instead of fancy. And when Cricket, you know, hears this, he thinks this, he realised, was the essence of art. It was precise. It was stratifying. Its specificity, its refinement, alienated someone like Ray, a dullard, and Ray is the other boy. So he's beginning to see that art and its rarefication can mean that you can share a language and a lexicon with people in a way that can go unnoticed by others.
And it also points to the further nuance in his argument. I guess I think I'm saying that this book contains an argument about art.
Yes.
That it's that precision that comes with the craft that accompanies art.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I guess, Cassie, I hope you would agree here. I hope I haven't very much misunderstood the brief, but, you know, it's basically a book about art versus commerce. and about the slippery slope from skill to, like, from skill and kind of aesthetic talent to discursiveness in the art world, I think. And what Eggers really dislikes, clearly, is the way that some conceptual artists and postmodern makers of art rely on theory and talking about stuff instead of actually knowing how to, you know, draw a beautiful illustration, or, you know how to prime a canvas and oil paint and all the things that, you know, make beautiful work. And instead, you know, we've got people taking a Polaroid of a poo and saying that's art, you know. I made that up. That's not in the book. But, yeah, he clearly has some thoughts about this.
Could I ask, Madeline, as your emergence into the commercial literary world, if you've got little tickles of recognition about those conflicts at all?
She's a pure artist, Tim Rogers.
I mean, I'm Caravaggio, Tim. I don't know what you mean. I mean, yeah, in the sense that the book is very much... It's different, though, in the art world as with literature, because with literature, you know, you're one person writing a book. But with art, in this kind of grand scale of commercialized art, which we'll get to later, it's one person having an idea and then a whole team of people actually making it, you know. So the person who is the artist isn't actually doing any of the making. So that doesn't really fly with literature.
Thank you. That's understood.
So let's just backtrack to that lovely beginning. So Pia, you mentioned as this girl, actually that's short for Olympia.
Yes.
But, in fact, she calls herself Albert Camus because she thinks she's channeling the French author, you know.
It's so good because she goes away for a while because her parents keep moving around. But her parents are clearly, like, richer and more cultured / well-to-do than Cricket's parents. And so she learns about, she has access to books in a way that Cricket doesn't. And so when she returns to Cricket's life a few years later as a teenager, she has decided that she is the physical embodiment of the soul of Camus. Mm. And she's so funny. Like, she's just the ultimate precocious teenage girl who's just so clever beyond her years.
Yeah, I mean, she's a bit of an archetype, isn't she?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she's ridiculous. I loved her.
Yeah, she's fun. She is a lot of fun. And, you know, for those following the art references, Olympia, of course, the, you know, extraordinary Manet painting naked amongst the suit-clad gentleman is actually a painting that's already appeared in the story before we even meet her. Silas, the grandfather, shows him it in a book. Mm. And the very, very young Cricket goes, oh, she's naked. That's weird. You know, it's sort of great. So, you know, it's analysing art on every level. But let's skip forward to that big debate about what is art.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the scariest three words you've ever heard at a dinner party. There's this scene where they are eventually at an art school.
Yeah.
And there's a crit. Now, you know what this is, where people have to present their work to their peers and their teachers, and there's feedback given. This is where we meet the character Paulson Arsenault, who's the university's head of painting and has a ponytail and is about 60 and wears denim pants with Converse.
So cool. Well,
bugger him.
But he's sort of famous for these artworks which are tiny and inscrutable, you know.
It's like squiggles.
Yeah, that's right. So the first student to display an artwork just puts a Polaroid of a painting by Richard Prince. It was huge in the 80s, photography, painting, everything, but he was sort of key to the sort of idea of the object and the idea separating, and it didn't matter about medium and whether it was even your painting, because he would take photos of other people's paintings. So this artist, Kyle, this young kid's called his Polaroid Reclaiming.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone thinks it's brilliant.
Oh, they're very excited. And everyone's using, you know, words like post-structuralist and existential and they're all just kind of frothing at the bit to acclaim Kyle an absolute genius. Meanwhile, all Kyle's done is like take a grainy photo with a Polaroid camera. But he says that's a statement about commercialization and bureaucracy and the aesthetics of, I don't know, nationalism, whatever, chucked a bunch of words in there.
I mean, remember, this is like the late 80s or 90s, I think, where we are.
Yeah. And so this happens, and then another artist pops up.
Sharon.
And Sharon can actually paint. She is really good at painting.
She's a fantastic drawer, like just exquisite.
Yeah, and she kind of does this like autobiographical crucifixion of herself in this beautiful old style. And Cricket is so blown away by this. He just thinks, God, like everyone's going to love her, surely. She's a genius.
I might as well leave uni.
Exactly. But of course this does not happen because everyone immediately starts, you know, attacking her like they're at a hen fight. She becomes the immediate object of disdain and people say, what you're doing here is, it's so unoriginal. It doesn't have your own point of view. There's no kind of political implication. And you should really go and leave and just go work at an advertising agency.
Yeah.
Because that's all you're good for.
I've got a friend who works in advertising and he says they're really looking for illustrators.
Yeah.
You know, like it's this eviscerating critique.
Yeah.
And into this, the guy who we come to know very well, Marcus Carpenter, and he just lets rip and he just decimates Kyle,
mm-hmm.
Arsenault, and stands up for Sharon in the most brilliant way and storms out. And it's it's a cataclysmic event in the novel. It's wonderful.
It is cataclysmic, but to my mind it was so melodramatic and the speech was like so didactic and moralistic. I was like, this is crazy. I'll just give you a sample of how he speaks.
Yeah.
You have been mistaught. You've been fed the lie that intent is achievement. It is not. It's like a kind of rousing political speech. And I wouldn't really mind that if there'd been a bit more build-up. But as it is, this is our first introduction to Crits at uni and also our first introduction to Carpenter. So it's almost like, to me, the novelist was like, I have this idea. I really want to get it down. I can't be bothered doing a bit of lead-up to it. And this is just going to be the first introduction at university to my thoughts. I found it a bit cloying.
Well, that's interesting because, Madeline, I think you're pointing there to the structure and that is this is a full life span within this novel. And so time is compressed. So I guess if it was going to be all about art school, we would have had a bit more lead up. But suddenly we're in this crit where he's saying, I mean, I think you left out some of his most.
Go off.
When we kill an artist, we kill ourselves. Yeah. Don't you see that? What I just witnessed was violence. It was cannibalism. And you call yourselves sensitive artists. It's really quite OTT.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, I was thinking of The World According to Garp when I was reading this and a few other more recent examples, maybe Franzen, but not quite at the intellectual level of, but it's quite populist mainstream novel explaining big art concepts.
Mm. Yeah.
And so they are writ large like that. There are goodies and baddies and there's craft versus art and, you know, lots and iterations of the self, the artist being naked to the world and then literally because there's a lot of life drawing in this. And I liked the attempt at doing it.
Mm.
And I did find myself moved by what happens to the characters.
Mm-mm. I think that when I started reading it, I was so excited. I thought the beginning passages and sections were great. They reminded me a little bit of some of the scenes in Las Vegas in The Goldfinch with Donna Tartt, mm-hmm. two boys running around and that kind of epic energy.
Mm.
But as it went on, I felt that the verve of the beginning lost itself a little. When I finished the novel, I felt a bit upset because I'd wanted so much more for it. But I was still kind of like, no, that's good. And then over a few days after I read it, I kept thinking about it. And each time I thought about it, I thought it was worse.
Yeah, right. Yeah. See, I got more and more generous towards it. There's the asymptote. It's called Contrapposto and it's by Dave Eggers.
On ABC Radio National, on ABC Listen, and on whichever book-filled podcast platform you choose, this is The Bookshelf with me, Kate Evans, with Cassie McCullough, with novelist Madeline Gray and rock star Tim Rogers. We've gathered our books and our opinions and we're getting stuck in.
Now to the writer Daniel Mason, a doctor and academic in the School of Psychiatry at Stanford University, whose novels include A Registry of My Passage Upon the Earth, The Winter Soldier and Northwoods, which we read here on the bookshelf in 2023.
I really liked Northwoods. It told the story of America through one house in Massachusetts, from when white settlers first arrived there and met the land's original owners through 250 years of characters and dramas and apple orchards.
A lot of apples.
And
I think that was a symbol, Kate, of America.
Well, he's exploring regional America in this latest novel of his too.
Yes. So this new book is called Country People. And the clue, I think, is in the title. You, Kate, and you, Tim, have read it. Where do we find ourselves, Kate?
Well, we're just over the border from his last book. We're in regional Vermont, and we spend a year with a family that has left the city for a new life. So Kate is an academic in literary studies. She's offered a position at the university. Miles Krzyzlewski, her husband, is 12 years into writing his PhD, but he's mostly a stay-at-home dad. There's a son, Wesley, a daughter, Olive, and a dog whose name is Giuseppe. But when this story begins, Tim, we're on this road trip, a sort of pilgrimage to a new life, a year-long adventure. But it takes us 30 pages before we actually learn their names. And I wondered whether we were going to get a sort of fable. I was quite relieved when I actually knew their names.
Oh, Kate, it's not the first time that we've agreed on something wholeheartedly that when, and it's the way they're introduced, the names through the daughter's paintings that she's doing on the drive. I thought, again, like you, I thought, oh, thank God we've got names. The way that the names are introduced, yes, there was relief. I thought if we're going to go with this fabulistic way of writing, my credulity is being tested, and how it's done through the daughter's paintings as she's painting in the back of the car. I found that very familiar. I did a lot of driving across the Nullarbor as a kid, you know, drawing and doodling in the back. After the road trip and for quite a bit of the novel, I felt that the stakes were... And it's a phrase that I'd previously hated that used to get brought up in theatre productions I was involved in, and a director would say, the stakes need to be raised. And I thought, bloody hell, all this talk about stakes. However, during this, I thought young, straight academic family, two wise and pithy children with gorgeous intellects and this very smart couple. And I thought, where are the stakes here? And that it took a while for... Here we go, the stakes to be raised. It was about two-thirds during the way of the book, and then I was just absolutely in, because a young academic family moving to rural Vermont, and the quirky nature of small-town Vermont, I thought, yeah, okay, we're kind of getting into Garrison Keillor territory, are we? But then the stakes are completely raised, and Kate, I hope I'm not stepping on your toe or toes, that what compounded that feeling until I dove right down into the mystery of the town and these myths around the town about this underground world, well, the kind of tennis ball theory of the world that was proliferating in this town, in the town's cognoscenti, was on the front of the novel. There's a quote from Mick Herron that says, "Full of joy, the book of the summer," the blurb on the front of this novel, and I thought, okay, I'm kind of living in that world, living in a country town with its wonderful characters, and then as the stakes arise, when this possibility, the story is told through the omnipotent narrator, but Miles, the father of the family, who's dealing with procrastination, he's over a decade into a dissertation on Tolstoy's village lifestyles and also Russian folk tales.
Let's talk a bit more about that, Tim, to sort of get people's sense of sort of whose perspective it is. So even though there is a narrator introducing us to everybody, it's really closely through this man Miles' eyes, who's a bit of a dreamer, a dilettante. I mean, he can't finish his academic work.
No. And again, I thought, okay, where's the interest in that? But then there are little flickers of he's possibly sliding into a depression. Now, I didn't know that Daniel Mason, the author, was a psychiatric professor. But I thought, oh dear, we're into a territory. And I felt this fear, and there'd only be flickers of it. And it was just a procrastination that, and even the narrator would indicate he's falling.
Well, he falls down rabbit holes, and those sort of rabbit holes of research are part of the sort of defining pleasure in this character's life. So he starts off looking at Russian folk tales, and then he's reading Tolstoy and goes, oh, gee, there's an awful lot of trains in here. Maybe I should write about trains in Russian literature. And then what about peasants in Russian literature? And he follows every rabbit hole, every interest. I mean, he struck me, Tim, as a real enthusiast. So he gets caught up in somebody else he meets who's into scything fields. And so as he learns to scythe, he's thinking, oh, I'm at one with the Russian peasants who are scything. And then somebody else is into...
This is very Anna Karenina.
Well, and there are references to Anna Karenina. There's
Don't mention the train.
Anna Karenina joke. No.
That journey will not end well.
Whole middle third of it about, you know, field propagation and scything, so...
Well, and he knows all of that, so that's part of the context.
Right.
And his wife, who is a quite successful academic and one of those teachers who inspires her students, she's an expert in Milton. But the idea of these rabbit holes and going down everything, that comes together, doesn't it, Tim, when they meet a man called Hugh, who... At first, who's a field guide, and if I can just give a quote, Hugh wasn't a flat earther. Hugh was a hollow earther, and his disdain for flat earthers seemed to match even his disdain for the general population who believed the world was solid at its core. So Hugh and other people in this town believe that the world is hollow, and that if you go down various tunnels, you're going to find a whole other world. And so this book is interspersed with colloquies of a man called Wilkes, who lived in the 19th century.
Jeremiah Wilkes. It's such a... Well, a Jeremiah Wilkes in 1802 is going to write colloquies, isn't he, Kate?
Well, he is, but colloquies about what? I mean, about apparently having disappeared under the earth. And at first we just think these are just wacky conspiracy theorists. But the character, Miles, he gets drawn into this, doesn't he, Tim?
He does, and through the probably the most interesting character in the book, apart from the kids or the dog, who is Snowflake Bentley, or this gentleman, African-American gentleman, overweight, is existing in a chair. He hangs around the emergency department where Miles is for a buggered-up leg that he injured while skiing. And Miles, he'll talk to anybody, and because he, in that lovely way that people could view him as a fool or as a dilettante, when really he's just interested in people, and his procrastination probably feeds into that, or it feeds into his procrastination. But this Snowflake, a gentleman who believes he's the reincarnation of Snowflake Bentley, who was a photographer.
A real photographer,
I beg your pardon, in the mid-19th century, Kate, is that correct?
I think the very turn of the 20th century, and he photographed snowflakes up close in Vermont.
So this gentleman believes through a Kabbalah transference of energy has become this reincarnation, or he's directly informed by Snowflake Bentley. And as Miles becomes very friendly in the reincarnation of Snowflake, becomes intimate with the family, he lets them all know that he spends his hours and days and minutes collating all the great fallacies of conspiracies and myths, including this tennis ball earth, vacant centre of the earth theory. But yet he's part of this society, the Jeremiah Wilkes Society in this town in Vermont, that is pursuing the one tunnel that will take him to this internal phantasmagoric world of maidens and winged horses, and which a large part of the town really believe in. And Miles, he's either guileless or just interested, gets drawn into it.
So the world, the earth itself is not empty. It's actually full of other worlds. Is that what we're suggesting here?
Yes, that if you go down this tunnel, you might find cities and landscapes and other people. And so they're searching for them.
Right.
They're searching for these entrances into another world. But that's just one part of this story. I mean, it's a very fragmentary novel. It's full of characters and small town characters, and like there's a trad wife, a sort of influencer whose name is Candace,
okay,
and who bills herself as Farm Candy,
sure,
who's terrible at actual farming but good at framing a shot on Instagram. And it's full of all of these sort of character portraits that are quite fascinating, and you get a sense that the author and this character he's created love people, love a Shaggy Dog story, are fascinated by characters and all the things that make up a town. And that becomes part of the pleasure of it as a reader. I mean, I found it quite sort of joyful, fascinating in the end. What about you, Tim?
Well, I'm now realising that my treatise about how much I didn't like the blurb on the front cover is collapsing in front of us.
So what actually happens? I mean, you've created this beautiful description of the world into which this family moves and the characters and some of these conspiracy theories or whatever they are. Maybe it's true. Well, I don't know. I shouldn't write it off too quickly. What's the actual, like, you know, functional forward motion?
As Miles goes further into wanting to know about these cracks and these tunnels in the world, the cracks in tunnels in their, not only in their marriage and relationship, but also in his possible fall into some sort of depression, we become more aware of them, that all is not well in the home life. And what the parents tell their kids, and their kids who are these sparkling intellects, they pick up on what's being said and what they're seeing, and a potential great tragedy could or could not happen because the youngest daughter overhears what Miles is talking about when he goes to these meetings of this vacant earth theorists.
Because stories matter in this book, and one of the things that Miles does is he has always told his children bedtime stories that he makes up, and at various points he's sort of traumatised these children, or they've believed things in a way that's not helpful. So some of it is being driven by the power of stories itself. The other is that we have this year, or we believe they're going to stay there just for a year. And the other thing is, this is a writer who's really interested in houses, and it's a slightly odd house that they're living in at the edge of town, at the edge of the woods. So there's that whole fairy tale thing. And the dog is hearing things and smelling things and sniffing around. So we do get this sense that there's something rumbling around, and all of that ties it together. And then right near the end, and we're not going to give away the plot, but there's a three-page footnote in the very last.
How very academic.
Well, and it's funny. I mean, yeah. I feel like part of the thing going on with this novel is that it's a satire,
yeah,
and it feels much more satirical than his earlier book. And occasionally the writer breaks the sort of fourth wall and says,
oh, yes, dear reader.
Ooh, yeah.
That was the bit that I bristled at. Kate, how about yourself?
Well, I was surprised because it broke the style. And at one point he says, the hike, it turned out, was to be the last family hike for a very long time. Indeed, for the rest of this novel, with one late notable exception. I thought, hang on, who are you talking to?
Yeah, hold yourself back, Tiger.
So it's quite playful, and he is sort of playing around with the form. So that jolted you out of the story, Tim.
Oh, very briefly. Look, I really, really love this book, and that I wasn't in love with it for the first 200 pages, but it was still, great characters. And I was a little self-aware because I moved to a country town myself, and my interest factor was there, and it was more than pithy. It was really hugely enjoyable. But then when the stakes were raised, I was the end. I was hoisting myself upon that stake and letting it pierce my flesh. It was really wonderful. So by the end, and unlike Kate, I haven't read Daniel Mason's previous books, and now I can't wait. I'm really looking forward to digging deep into them, like a dog, like a truffle hunting dog, digging through the floorboards.
And Giuseppe is a truffle hunting dog, but there are no truffles to be had in that usually pigs.
No spoiler alerts, Kate. There are no truffles.
That's the real kind of crux of the plot. They've been waiting for truffles the whole time, and there bloody aren't any.
Oh, well, maybe this is the book that changes the expression raising the stakes to digging up the truffles. Yeah. All right.
Digging for truffles feels delightfully smutty, doesn't it?
And you can find all of that in Daniel Mason's Country People.
Wow. Okay. Well, two similar American novels I think we've heard about today. What about some book recommendations? First to you, Madeline Gray. What have you been reading and enjoying?
Okay. So two books. The first one is called Dream Girls by Hannah Goldstein. It's not out yet. I'm sorry to do this. It comes out in November. But she is an Australian debut novelist. And the book is a kind of like a contemporary retelling of A Midsummer Night's Dream, but focuses on Helena and Hermia, their dynamic. But in the novel, they're called Helena and Ruthie. It follows them from school when they're both outcasts and they develop a like very intense relationship that's fueled by jealousy pretty much between both of them. And then it follows them into their lives as young adults and parents. I love a book like this. Like, I kind of wrote a book like with a not dissimilar plot. And I think this is a very welcome addition to the canon. There's lots of popular culture references, even though it's kind of, it's like literary slash commercial fiction, but it's quite deeply sad. There is a pathos to it that actually really affected me and I felt it really got into my head. So I would recommend that.
Yeah.
And then the other one is an older book that I read for the first time called Brother of the More Famous Jack by Barbara Trepido, which is 1982. And apparently it's very famous, but I'd never heard of it. And it was so much fun. It is about a young woman, Catherine. It's sort of in the 1960s begins and it's in London and Oxford, and she starts at university in London and becomes embroiled in the life of this bohemian academic family. And then it's like a coming of age tale, but it's so charming. It just had the kind of whimsy of a certain kind of British novel, like maybe like a Margaret Drabble, like The Millstone. Mm-hmm. It's just
the
sentences are just like chef's kiss. They're so good. And I was just giggling the whole time, and now I'm reading all of her books. So yeah, Brother of the More Famous Jack, Barbara Trepido, excellent.
And that was her debut novel.
Was it? Yeah. I didn't even know that. It's exceptional.
Is it a reference to My Brother Jack?
Yes,
all?
I think so.
George Johnson.
There are a fair few jokes such as that throughout.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Tim Rogers, what have you been reading and loving?
I had the delight of reading The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie.
Did you love it?
I absolutely loved it. By Muriel Spark, thanks to my friend Madeline. Read it in Texas, which is the incongruous book club continues. Also had a neighbour drop around a beautiful Bildungsroman book called River Boy by a gentleman, Jim Ewing, Victorian, released on Ginninderra Press. A beautiful story about a young boy growing up in Warrnambool with his rather stoic Scottish parents. I enjoyed it immensely. And then in a lovely little bit of serendipity, I got sent Jock Sarong's soon-to-be-released biography of Fletcher Jones called The Suitable Man. And if you don't know the history, it's very Warrnambool-based. So Jim Ewing's River Boy is based in Wollongong, Warrnambool, I beg your pardon. And Jock Sarong, A Suitable Man, the Fletcher Jones story. It's based around Warrnambool as well, where my father's family is from. So there was a little bit of kismet there. I also was lucky enough to get sent Michelle Johnston's just-to-be-released new book, 50 Beating Wonders. I love Tiny Uncertain Miracles so much. And then she sent me a manuscript of 50 Beating Wonders. If you don't know Michelle Johnston, she works as a surgeon in an emergency department in Perth Royal Hospital. This is more of a memoirish talking about what it's actually like to work as a doctor in an emergency department, but it's also mixed with facts about the human body, about our bodies internally. And I just, again, took so many notes, and you won't take a step without thinking about what your valves and your the push and pull of your ventricles, which sounds like a smutty euphemism. Johnson's 50 Beating Wonders. It's really gorgeous. And because I'm off to Poland next year, being the handbag for Alice Topp, the genius, reading Polish books, and I'm into Olga Tokarczuk and her nonfiction collection called Flights. And if anyone has any Polish recommendations, throw a donut at me as I'm walking down the street and tell me about your favourite Polish authors.
Be careful what you wish for, Tim Rogers.
You'll get over the Polish books.
The entire Australian donuts. Polish community will be.
Hit me with a pierogi. Is it pierogi?
Pierogi.
Pierogi, I beg your pardon.
Well, I love the collection of books that you have both recommended. And for anybody who's scrambling for a piece of paper to write them down, never fear, we do list them all on the bookshelf page or in the show notes if you're listening to us on a podcast or an ABC Listen. It's all there, we promise.
Hey, great talking books with you both. Wonderful yet again. Thank you.
This is absolutely one of the highlights of the month. Now let's all go stuff ourselves with Barocci.
Thank you both.
Bye.
Well, there they go. Madeline Gray, writer, scholar. Her novel, Chosen Family, has been released in the US this week. And Tim Rogers, musician, actor and frontman of UMI, whose 2017 memoir is called Detours. Now, Kate, you have also this week read a book by the Finnish-Australian writer Maria Takalander.
Yes. Now, she's best known as a poet, I think, as well as a literary scholar, although she has written some short fiction. Her poetry collection from 2021, Trigger Warning, was really quite something. But now she's written her first novel, and it's called The End of Romance.
Okay. So The End of Romance, where are we and when?
Well, we're not entirely sure as the story opens, because we're in a house. There's a child in bed calling out to his mother. And so inside this apparently ordinary domestic scene, she then creates an entire world that shows you that the house isn't quite a house as we might expect it to be. There's no power. There's no water coming out of the taps. There is something called fog collectors outside. And then we realise that this house is in a suburb of other abandoned houses. And so from the inside out, she's building this sort of post-apocalyptic world where this woman, the mother, is somebody who scavengers things. She's a forager.
It's a bit The Road-ish, is it? Cormac McCarthy.
Well, the feel is quite different, but I guess it's similar in that it is a sort of post-apocalyptic climate change. Something has happened, but there are other people living in this world. I mean, she has a mother who's living her precarious life in a slightly different way, in a sort of hyper-feminine way, whereas our unnamed character doesn't care about how she looks, what she's wearing. She doesn't engage with other people very much. She's very much focused on her son. Her son is about 8 and he does go to a school. Only boys go to this school. Their heads are shaved. They're wearing sort of overalls and they're there until they're 16, at which point the boys are sent off somewhere to a sort of promised land. So it's this strange, eerie world.
Is it recognisably Australian?
Well, at first I wasn't sure where it was, and I think the clues suggest that we're somewhere else, possibly in Europe, and that's partly reference to some of the plants that we see. But this is a denuded landscape. So even though there are houses, there are remnants of things. You know, there are foxes, but of course there are foxes in Australia. There are foxes everywhere else.
So it's deliberately obscured.
I think it's deliberately obscured, but it keeps upending our expectations. So at first we're inside the worldview of this woman and her son, and then we do meet another character, a stranger, a man, and it's unusual for a man to be there because most of them have been sent off. But we think that's going to change the narrative in a particular way, and it's not quite what we expect. She keeps on destabilizing us, and it's fascinating.
So we're always seeing through her eyes.
In the first section, we're seeing through her eyes. Then there's a small section where we're reading a pamphlet from this very strange expedition. Then we meet the man, and then at the end we get another character's perspective, and I won't tell you who. And so even what we think we know from the mother's perspective, when we see somebody else looking at her, we see her completely afresh. She's almost blank and she doesn't speak. Like, she's a woman of action. and we get some of her backstory. There'd been a man in her life, a boyfriend of her mother's, who taught her to hunt and how to survive. And so it's this quite brutal world that we're in, and it's deliberately sort of strange and beautiful and a bit poetic all at the same time.
So it's more Station 11, Emily St. John Mandel, less Mad Max.
Yeah, it's not...
although, it's not as fun as Mad Max.
And it's not quite as bleak as The Road, but it's not cheerful. I mean, this is... we're in the realms of climate fiction, of asking what's happened to the world, of trying to work out why the streets look as they do, why there's sand, why everybody's having to think about water. So it's in that genre, but it doesn't feel derivative.
Okay, so it feels fresh and well imagined.
It really does. Mm. And it's partly because we're imagining it from the inside rather than getting these the sort of big picture that I'm giving you, because that emerges slowly throughout the book.
Okay, well, that is one to pick up. It's called The End of Romance, and it's by Maria Takalander.
Okay, well, how about now on the bookshelf, we start to think more about favourite books in the lead up to the Top 100 Australian Books Countdown.
Yes, as you may well know, we have already announced this year's theme for the Top 100 books, and it's going to be Australian. So there's no time limit. It could have been published yesterday or 100 and 200 years ago. Are there 200-year-old books, Australian books, Kate?
I was in the State Library of New South Wales recently reading about the very first book published in Australia, which was printed in about 1812, and it was a collection of sort of legislation and rules,
actually. Yarns.
Yeah, it might be on somebody's top 10.
Well, isn't that ironic that the first book that we know of published in Australia was all about rules?
Yeah.
I think Robert Hughes would be laughing in the big beyond about that.
Well, that's such a great reminder too, that when people are thinking about their favourite Australian books, we're talking fiction as well as non-fiction. So people might well have the work of Robert Hughes on their own list of top 10. Voting begins at the end of August, but we're getting things started by asking writers to select their own top three books.
Yeah, what we thought we'd do is just ask some Australian writers, and maybe we might even branch out further, Kate, but just ask them for three books they love, just to sort of get us going, because you and I have both had to submit our top 10.
Nearly killed me already.
It's so hard.
I submitted 20, and just
you,
by the way.
Oh, but then you go, oh, was it that good? And then you can't think of, oh, no. Oh, then as soon as you put it in, you want to change it. So anyway, it's just something to get you going. So
here's novelist George Kemp, and he'll introduce himself to you.
I am an author and a playwright and a former actor, and I spent about 20 years making theatre and acting in Australia and in England, and have been writing plays for the last 10 years, and wrote my debut novel this year called Soft Serve, which came out in Feb. Soft Serve is about three 20-somethings and their dead friend's mum, and they are all stuck in a regional McDonald's as bushfires close in, and it's an exploration of friendship and loss and grief and a little queer story that runs through it, and, you know, a bunch of people wanting something else somewhere else.
And a really interesting portrait of regional Australia. I really like the way that you did that as well. But let's turn to that impossible question of your favourite Australian books. Long term, we're asking you to select 10, but today I want you to focus on just three. What is the book that you would want to begin with?
I would like to begin with Cloud Street by Tim Winton. It's a story set in Western Australia, beginning as the Second World War comes to a close, and it's about two families, the Pickles and the Lambs, and yes, that sounds like a pub lunch, as they say in the book, and both families suffer a separate tragedy. Sam Pickles loses his hand in a winch while at work, and the Lamb's son, Fish, nearly drowns one evening, leaving him with a brain injury. And as a result of these two traumas, these two families find themselves coming together and moving into a big, breathing, ramshackle house at number one Cloud Street. And what follows is, you know, a story of people stamping and laughing and singing and shouting directly in life's face is what it feels like. And everyone's just trying to be happy and do good and live a prosperous life. And it kind of shows us that life is one big old gamble. And, you know, it's all dependent on the shifty shadow of Lady Luck.
And I want to hear more about what it is that you got out of that book. But before we do that, George, tell us how you came to read this book.
I came to read this book because I saw the play of it first. And in 1998, Sydney Festival put on a production of this play with Belvoir and with Black Swan. And they did a site-specific version of it down on the wharves. And
so on Sydney Harbour.
Mm-hmm. And what was so stunning about this production was at the end of this play, and all through the play, we hear that Fish Lam just wants to be back in the water. And at the end of the play, Dan Wiley, the actor playing Fish, ran down the end of the jetty and jumped off the jetty into the harbour. And it was one of the most breathtaking moments that kind of only theatre can produce, seeing this character so fully achieve their objective in front of an audience's eyes and these gasps and everything. And so I was like, what is this thing? What is this amazing story? And then I read the book.
How old were you?
I would have been about 12 when I saw the play. And then a couple of years later, I had an English teacher who taught me, you know, how to read a book basically through The Quiet American by Graham Greene. And then I read this book after that. And so it was the first book I feel like I read as a, you know, teenager who was 15, 16, and really knew how to read a book. You know, people say things that they don't mean. And it was just like a thrilling thing to read this book about Australia that is just so broad in what it tries to bring in. It's a book about a house, but underneath it, it's a book about this tension between a sense of home and also its opposite. You know, there's a line in it, I think, where Dolly says, like, all night, all day, people seem to be going someplace else. You know, everyone wants to be somewhere else. And it gives this sense, I think, that, like, Australia opened up a bit during the First World War and there was this sense of something else out there that wasn't what we were used to. And there's this restlessness in it that I just find so appealing.
And when you say this is a book that taught you how to read, tell us more about what you mean by that.
I think that I had this sense that, you know, a book needs to have this hero and we follow this hero through this journey. And this is a true ensemble piece, this book. And so you can just take something from all of these different characters and it feels unusual in that way that it, you know, there's these characters that want something so deeply, but then they act against those impulses and they go in the opposite. And Winton does this incredible thing because this idea of the shifty shadow of luck that is so present in this book, there's this amazing tension device that as soon as something really good happens, you know that lurking around the corner, someone's about to be disappointed. And so it just pulls you through this story in that way.
This is a novel set in and about Western Australia. But how much were you reading it with that image of a young man jumping into Sydney Harbour? I mean, how much did that theatrical perspective inform your reading?
It informed so much of it because there's so many moments through the book that are deeply theatrical. There's almost a bit of a kind of magic realism to it. And so having seen this book interpreted so theatrically on stage with boats and stars and all of these things, it really expanded what a book could be to me as a reader and as a writer as well.
And so there's the stage and all the theatricality on the one hand, but also this is a novel, as you said, that is centred upon a house. So what does that sort of architectural space of this novel, what does that add to it? What does that mean?
It gives us this amazing sense of these two halves, you know. There's these two completely different families that are perhaps more different than they think that they are. And there's a fence running down the middle, you know, and that sort of feels like what we're living in now as well, that there's these fences everywhere that are separating everybody in our country, in Australia. And, you know, this book is about how we tear down those fences ultimately. And so the fact that they're contained within this house just it heightens this sense of restlessness that's in the book of everybody just wanting to live a good life, and everything is in the way of that, including this house that they live in, which they kind of get for free, I think. I don't know.
What is the next book that you would like to present for us?
I would like to talk about The Sun Walks Down by Fiona McFarlane. So we're in the Flinders Ranges in 1883, and a six-year-old child, Denny, is lost in the outback in the strange, magical Australian sun. And you know, society around him grapples with who is responsible for both his loss and his finding. In a country that is barely a child itself, or so the white people in the book would have you believe, how do they work together to find this boy while he and they are still intact? And the story is of such a scale that it begins to become less about Denny and finding Denny, and explores what that incident has done or does to the lives of the people around it, and how it illuminates the parts of themselves that might be missing.
So with that description, that almost sounds like a familiar story. You've got a lost child, a potentially hostile Australian landscape and Australian history, and yet she does something surprising with it. So what is it that makes this not a cliche of Australian history and Australian landscape?
I think what's fresh is its scale and its focus on its characters. It's an enormous, enormous book. There's a line in it that a Swedish artist says where he says quite simply, this country and everything in it is too large, and no man, certainly no artist, like to be reminded of his smallness by comparison. And it feels like this is a book where every single character in this book thinks that they're the hero. And I think that every single character in this book is mistaken by that.
What about the emotional reading of this book? I mean, how did it make you feel?
I loved this book so much because there's so many emotional hooks to hang your hat on, you know? And like, there are so many, there's all of these daughters in the family of the boy that is missing, and you care about every single one. And they all miss Denny or want Denny back for a different reason. And everyone is fighting for attention in that family and also in the whole book. And so you feel that there's this, you know, overarching objective of get the boy back. But underneath that, everyone has these deeply, deeply, deeply personal little mini earthquakes that have happened because this boy has gone missing. And that's what brings everything to the surface for them. What McFarlane does so well in this book as well is that she takes people experience such a specific moment of personal chaos, but she just writes it with such incredible control, and it is so, so specific that you can hang your hat on any emotional character in this book, and you will chart them through. And it's a big book, and so you have a chance to really get to know these characters, even though it takes place over 7 days. I think it's just immense.
That's Fiona McFarlane's The Sun Walks Down. What is your selection for number three in your list of 10?
My next selection is Cold Enough for Snow by Jessica Howe. So Cold Enough for Snow is about a woman and her mother who are travelling around Japan on a holiday. And they take trains, they visit galleries and museums, and they eat meals together. And there is a space between them that this trip is designed to close. And Cold Enough for Snow is, it's like a beautiful, crisp, crystal river. It's a pay under paying attention. And it asks what the role of art is in all its forms. What role does art play in the act of being present, whether that is with oneself or with another? There's a line in the book that says, perhaps it was all right not to understand all things, but simply to see and hold them. And I think that this book is a, you know, poetic and achingly beautiful instruction manual on how to do exactly that.
The two other books that you selected could be described as sprawling, characterful, colourful, emotional stories. This one is very different. So what is it about this novel that appeals to you?
You're right. It's the total opposite. Couldn't be shorter. Couldn't be shorter. This book is so hard to describe, and that is exactly why I love it. And I've read it multiple times and I've listened to it, and it's almost like a beautiful song in that it's short enough that you can reread it and reread it and try and consistently try and figure out its little riddles. And overall, I think it's a book about familiarity, and that's what I love about it.
What do you mean, familiarity?
Familiarity with one's self, familiarity with one's surroundings, with our fears, with our shortcomings, and most importantly, with our closest relationships, which, you know, quite often, of course, can be the ones within which there is the largest gulf. And, you know, she says at the start she doesn't know exactly why she feels like she needed to go on this trip with her mother, but she just feels that she does. And so we're trying to kind of work that out with her as we go. And so much of it, the novel is about proximity. There's so much proximity to ideas, to artworks, to their physical bodies in space. And it's like they're kind of connected by some sort of elastic through this book that is just stretching and coming together and pulling apart. And you get this sense that that's their entire lives. And my mother comes from a generation where, you know, neither joy nor sadness are displayed to the extremes. And that can often lead to some sort of distance. And so I think about this book a lot in conversations with my own mother. And you see these moments where the narrator in this book is worried that her mother's not going to be able to handle this thing, or she does this thing for her. And then later it's the mother that brings her the warm food, you know, and there's this symbiotic relationship that is happening between these two characters that is explored through art and explored so obliquely, but somehow so deeply. And so it's just, it's a constant riddle to me, this book. And it sort of taught me as a writer that whether your writing is, you know, deeply poetic or extremely prosaic, like a lot of this book is, it doesn't matter. It just needs to be specific and it's going to touch somebody.
Novelist, actor and playwright George Kemp with his three favourite Australian novels, Tim Winton's Cloud Street, Fiona McFarlane's The Sun Walks Down, very popular that one, and also Jessica Au's Cold Enough for Snow. We'll bring you some of these selections each week so you can fine-tune your list for voting in September.
That's it for this week's edition of The Bookshelf, but Cassie McCullough, you're heading off for a few weeks.
Yeah, I'm off for a couple of weeks, but you've got some big books ahead of you.
Yes, I'll be back next time with Colson Whitehead's Cool Machine, a new translated novel about Frida Kahlo, and a Chinese story of care and isolation from the Chinese-Australian writer Isabel Lee.
Well, I'm envious already. I'm Cassie McCullough.
I'm Kate Evans. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.